Joint Ways and Means Public Safety Committee, February 8, 2005, 1 p.m. in the Coffee Creek facility.
Public Safety Committee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And as you probably noticed, this is a little bit unusual. We are actually being amplified. So in the committee rooms, you're not amplified. You're just simply recorded. But it does appear that you are. You are. So we'll go to the first agenda item, which should be Max. Yeah, I'm looking at this long list. Come forward, Director Williams.
The chair, just so you know, this item, I guess, is the same with what's in your notebooks. So you don't necessarily need a handout for the audience to come on back to the table.
Are you ready for me to begin, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Chair...
I almost feel like I can't breathe up here. Because
so close. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I want to first thank you for allowing us the time to begin our budget presentation before the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. I also want to welcome you to the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility here in Wilsonville. Obviously, this is our first time having a legislative hearing on the road, and it presented some logistical challenges typically for the accommodation of a public meeting. We're anxious to have you tour the facility later this afternoon, and we're not typically in a place to accommodate much outside the facility in large groups, and because this was a public meeting, we couldn't have it inside the facility because typically getting into our facilities are... it presents a challenge, as it should, and wasn't the right spot to do a public meeting. But we are here in this building, which we refer to, this is probably my first acronym, so I've put my money up there for the pig, as OISC, which is the Offender Information and Sentence Computation Unit of the Department of Corrections. So the building that you're in provides all of the records management for not only the 13,000 offenders currently incarcerated, but records management on those who have previously offended and remain under supervision, as well as record management for former offenders. So essentially everybody who's been in the system or remains in the system is currently, the records information is managed through this central records office. Another important function that the office that we're, the building that we're sitting in performs for the department is the sentence computation work. As you heard yesterday in your presentation from both Craig Prinz at the Criminal Justice Commission and from Sue Porter, Oregon has a fairly challenging and complicated sentencing policy and practice. The determination of the right length of time to ensure that a person serves the sentence that they have been ordered to serve by the court is not as simple as simply looking at one piece of paper and figuring out how long the department would keep them. Those that qualify for things like earned time, that calculation has to be factored in. The amount of time someone may have stayed in a county jail prior to their incarceration has to be calculated as well. So we have prison term analysts who actually do that work, whose job it is to review the sentences and then determine the appropriate sentence length. And as you can imagine, with the kind of growth that the department has seen and our general population, that's a really a never-ending job for the people who work here at OISC. So it's an opportunity to showcase a little bit of a corner of the department that we typically don't get to talk very much about, but I wanted you to understand the building you were in and where you were at currently within the department.
Director Williams, can you, for the committee's information, explain the seriousness of the issue of your routine and inmates longer than they should have been retained?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we take very seriously ensuring that we get the right amount of time on an individual sentence as was ordered by the court. It obviously would present a legal liability to the department were we to retain someone beyond the term of their legal sentence, along with just being plain wrong. At the same time, we're very cautious about releasing people in advance of the time that they had been ordered by the court to serve. So these people do a very technical job, and one that we require, obviously, a substantial amount of proficiency at, because the mistakes one direction or the other are potentially very costly to the department and erode people's confidence and trust in the public safety system. So we take it very, very seriously, and they do as well. I will comment that it is not uncommon, as I'm talking to people about particular sentence issues, and I would tell you that I think if you took a handful of judges, a handful of district attorneys, and a handful of defense counsel, and you set them down at the table and you handed them a particular scenario and asked them with the various information to calculate the sentence, I'm not sure you would necessarily get agreement as to what the sentence length ought to be. So we're taking these people who lack a legal education, who work for us as prison term analysts, and we give them a lot of responsibility, and it is a real challenge to ensure that they are getting those calculations right, and they do a tremendous job in doing that. I won't say that we're always 100% error-free, but given the resources and the volume, I think this unit does an extremely good job doing its work.
Chairman?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Director Williams, you said you have all this data. Is it shared with other law enforcement people, and do you have DNA on all your people in facilities now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnant, the basic information about sentences and convictions is actually managed through the LED system, the law enforcement data system, which we have access to. And so that information is generally shared, and the LED system is ran through the Oregon State Police, have responsibility for LEDs. The actual files that we have are hard files. Much of that information is eventually put on computer, much of it is not. And one of the challenges we have is this unit has to deal with, as a person comes in, determining whether or not we have all the necessary information from their county where they were sentenced. So this unit also does a fair amount of work in trying to fill in the gaps with police reports and other kinds of records that have to be assembled. So the automation component of this for sharing across the system is not as strong as you might wish to have it. The issue of a statewide criminal justice system that has all of that integrated involvement is something that still remains, I think, a goal generally of the public safety community. And I assume at some point during the course of the session you may even have some conversations about that in broader terms. With respect to the DNA information, we do not have DNA information on every inmate. There is a process by which certain inmates are where the DNA information is collected. And I'm not the one to probably answer you the specifics on that, but Mr. Zerniak, who is our Assistant Director of Operations in the later parts of the presentation in Phase 2, would be happy to respond to those questions for you. And we can talk about some of that on the tour when we're in intake, where some of that is done.
In terms of the DNA issues also, when we have the state police before us and we have the forensics division before us, they'll be able to answer some of your questions, because there is an issue of a backlog, but they're actually making a lot of progress on that backlog,
right.
And they think that they may even have adequate resources to proceed and get that backlog taken care of within a reasonable period of time. Now back to your regular presentation.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. And I thought I'd take just a second at the beginning to share with you at least my objectives for the Phase 1 portion of our presentation. And it really is to meet your needs in providing you information and responding to the questions you have. We're obviously making an effort to follow both the co-chairs and the subcommittee chairs' directions with respect to what information you want to present in Phase 1 and Phase 2. It's my hope that we'll be able to provide you a useful overview of the department, its functions, as well as the information that's going to be helpful for you in making both budget and policy decisions. I'm going to start out with a broad overview of our division's programs. We'll get, probably not today, but sometime tomorrow, into our performance measures and priority list and the 10% reduction plan. Also share with you the affirmative action information that I understand the committee has requested. And that would be our plan, at least for what I would think would take us through most of today and part of tomorrow. I would hope that we would use the remainder of the time to discuss our growth management plan, review those alternatives, and discuss House Bill 5331, which is the department's requested authorization to move forward on the Madras construction and the expansion at Coffee Creek, and then obviously time to respond to any questions that the committee had. It would be tempting, I think, to immediately get into discussions about population management issues, and I'm going to resist that temptation, at least for the next day or so, to try to provide you the framework and the broad overview of the department in a way that I think will be helpful to that discussion as we start discussing the bigger issues involving population management later in the week. I do want to share with you the context, obviously, that you heard some about yesterday with respect to the issues that are facing the department in population management as it relates to the impacts of Ballot Measure 11, Ballot Measure 17, which requires that all inmates work 40 hours a week to participate in some program-based activity for that period of time, and Senate Bill 1145, which is the Community Corrections Bill, which also has changed over the last decade the functions of the department. I think understanding that context as we move through some of this will be helpful, and I'm not going to bore you with a lot of those details now, but as they arise throughout the presentation at various points, I'll attempt to make reference to them. I also just want to say at the beginning of my comments here that it has truly been a privilege for me in the last, I guess now moving on to 13 months, that I've been the director of the Department of Corrections. These are an exceptional group of people that I have an opportunity to work with. They do a very, very difficult job with a group of Oregonians that, by and large, people would like to pretend don't exist, in environments that are extremely challenging. And while we have our occasional problems and pitfalls, I would tell you that I am daily impressed by the level of dedication and commitment that the employees of the Department of Corrections demonstrate, their commitment to public safety, their commitment to the state of Oregon, their commitment to making this department a better place to work and a better public servant every single day. On page one of your presentation, you'll simply see our identification of our statutory authority and mission. I want to focus, obviously you're aware of our constitutional obligations with respect to the criminal justice system, which is protection of society, personal responsibility, accountability for one's actions, and reformation. This ties directly into the mission the department has, which is to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing the risk of future criminal behavior. As I've shared with this committee before, our efforts here are to create less victims of crime in Oregon in both those missions. One is by taking people who have been persistent or who have engaged in criminal activity and removing them from society and keeping society safe by their incarceration, but also by the delivery of programs and services that will lower the likelihood that when they do release back to the community that they will commit crime. And it is that fundamental principle that I want us to sort of hold out there in our recollection as we move through this process. Below that, on page two, you'll see our reference to our vision statement that guides the department, and I won't take the time to read that, but this is posted throughout the department and one that we reference regularly in our conversations about where we're headed. Before I came to the department, under the direction of former Director Dave Cook and the interim directors who served between Director Cook and myself as the next permanent director, the department continued to emphasize its primary business strategy, which is the Oregon Accountability Model. And I will take a minute to talk to you just briefly about the Oregon Accountability Model, because it ties directly back to a conversation we'll have about our performance measures and our tie back to the Oregon benchmark number 64, which is the percentage of paroled adult offenders convicted of a new felony within 3 years of initial release. That is the launching point for most of our performance measures and our overall department business strategy. The Oregon Accountability Model is really identified on page two and a little bit on page three as it moves over, but it really is that transition of an offender back to the community begins at intake. You've heard this number, and I'll repeat it again for you today. 95% of everyone that we have currently incarcerated will eventually release into the community, whether they're serving a lengthy sentence or a short sentence. There are only about 5% of our population that at some point won't release back into the community. So we do believe and practice the policy that transition begins at intake. We develop a corrections plan for each inmate. That's done at the intake facility here at Coffee Creek, which we'll show you. That corrections plan is then used throughout that person's stay at the department to attempt to program them appropriately for the right kinds of interventions that we think will, in fact, lower their future criminality. We hold inmates accountable by providing both positive and negative consequences to the inmate behavior, and we focus on the efforts to have pro-social role modeling within the system. We think that if you pro-social interact with inmates in that manner, it increases the likelihood that they will model those same behaviors when they release. We attempt to prepare inmates for community living through appropriate work and programs while they're in the system. Work education and focused treatment and reentry programs, again, to the extent that we have the resources to provide those programs. Inmates have the opportunity to develop healthy relationships with families, and we have a Children's for Incarcerated Parents program, probably as strong as anywhere here at Coffee Creek, with our female population and the interaction with their children. And there's a substantial amount of data that would reflect that those are key factors in whether or not someone is going to successfully transition back to community, or those community relationships they develop, and key of those is the family. We plan the release back to community with the inmates, the community stakeholders, and the community corrections individuals who will have supervisory responsibility. Our supervision in the community is consistent with the corrections plans and principles as we work with our county stakeholders. And focus on those factors that are tied to their likely recidivism, if it will occur. And we attempt to use outcome and research-based and evidence-based programming in delivering these services. So those are the key elements of the Oregon Accountability Model, and it really is a function of a business strategy for the department that we follow regularly and attempt to relate back most of our key decision-making to that business strategy. Again, the keys are to reduce victimization, to enhance public safety, and to help control the increasing public cost of incarceration. And I've shared this number with some of you before, but we release about 4,000 inmates a year, and over a three-year period of time, that equates to about 12,000 individuals being released to the community. We get about a third of them back within that three-year period of time who recidivate, slightly around 30%. If you do the math on that, our average length of stay for those individuals is about 2.2 years. So the DOC cost associated with recidivism is about $58,000 per recidivating inmate.
Director Williams, is that $4,000 a year, is that only the inmates that you directly release, or does it include the 1145 that the counties may release?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my recollection is that that is just the inmates that the department actually releases back to the community. So if you do the math over a three-year period of time, what you can figure is that we're spending somewhere, just the Department of Corrections budget is spending somewhere in the neighborhood of about $200 million over a three-year period of time on inmates who are recidivating and coming back into the system. So our efforts to invest and manage and attempt to drive down recidivism is obviously going to be key to helping us control the increasing cost of public incarceration. I want to walk you through the organizational charts of the department here, because I think it will help you understand how we're organized. I first have to start out with a note that in June I announced a reorganization of the department. And so what I'm going to show you is an org chart that existed at the time the legislature met last, and then I'll show you one that reflects the changes that I made to the organizational structure of the department in July, and then I'll show you the difference between that current organizational operating chart and how it is reflected in the governor's recommended budget. So there are three charts you're going to look at. The July 2000 reorganization, to give you a sense, we were structured, if you look at the organizational chart on page 5, we were structured essentially with six assistant directors operating divisions within the department. We had an institutions division, a correctional programs division, human resources was a separate division, business and finance a separate division, information systems and services a separate division, and community corrections operated as a separate division. And you'll see those reflected two there on that top line, community corrections separately coming off of the administration tree, and then the three under central support operations were operating as three separate divisions within the department. In 2004, I reorganized in a way that eliminated the Correctional Programs Division and established a Transitional Services Division that combined all the functions relating to inmate transition, including community corrections, into a single division in the department. I consolidated the central business and infrastructure functions of the agency into a new General Services Division, and I created a new Operations Division, eliminating the old Institutions Division by bringing over the functions of physical health, mental health, and pharmacy into the single Operations Division. And I kept the Human Resources Division as a separate operating division within the department. So you'll see then the changes that are reflected on the chart on page 6, which gives you now the current operating structure of the department. I made several other changes with respect to this organization. I brought the research office of the department inside the scope of the director's office, and I also had the planning and budget portion of the department brought into the director's office as well as a direct report function to central administration. So those two offices were pulled into the central administration function. I did this because I felt like it was important to align the functions of the division more towards our core mission. Key to this was making sure that all the efforts of our transitional services effort, because of its importance in the long-term success of the agency, needed to be located in a single division. Also to bring all of the various business and finance operations of the department centrally to our General Services Division, I thought made a cleaner operation. And finally, the moving of the health services, counseling, treatment, and pharmacy functions out of the programs division with its elimination and into the operations division allowed a closer alignment of the resources being provided on the ground to the inmates in the institutions through a central operations function. So those were the changes that were made in July for the reorganization. It was a significant reorganization, and the department, I think, did a very good job with it, and change is always difficult, but people were up to the challenge, and I appreciated the support I received from the employees and staff at the department as we went through that process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Williams, maybe the chair, are we going to get into more detail on these positions and what they're responsible for, so I don't need to, like my question, Doug, is the Inspector General's Office and Internal Audits Division, why that's separate and how that, what they, so we're going to wait on that? Shall I wait on that?
I believe in phase two we will get into that, and also we will get the principal budget books for the Corrections Division, which I have a feeling will probably cover about half of one of these tables once you get all the...
And Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, I'll actually take just a moment here in a few minutes of my presentation to walk you through each of these divisions, along with the Central Administration Division, and briefly touch on what each of these functions do. You'll have plenty of opportunity in phase two as each of these individual assistant directors get up and present on these functions in more detail, but I will give you a bit of a sense of what each of these do, just so you have a bit of an operating context as you move through the process. So with that, I will walk you through essentially the five program units for our budget presentation. The five operational units are the Operations Division, the Central Administration Division, and I'm now on page 8 of my presentation, a General Services Unit, the Transitional Services Division, and the Human Resources Division. And we have several other program units for capital improvement, capital construction, and debt service, which are going to be referenced later and in the bigger budget books that we'll talk about during phase two. I also just will note for you briefly, as it's noted here in the presentation, ballot measure 68, adopted by the people in November 1999, established the Oregon Correctional Enterprises, which was generally referred to as the old prison industries section. They were created as a separate, semi-independent state agency no longer supported by the department's general fund budget. So they are now offline from with respect to budget. Our relationship is that I appoint the OCD administrator, and they employ about 1,100 of our 12,700-plus inmates. And we can obviously share more information with you about OCE at another time, but they're not, you may see them referenced in the big budget books, but since the change in 99, they're no longer part of the department's budget or the budget presentation. So I'm going to start first with our largest division for purposes of conversation, which is the operations division. The operations division is about 60% of the department's overall budget. It is the division that has the responsibility for overall security, housing, and population management of our adult offenders and those juveniles that were sentenced under Measure 11 as felony offenders. We will see, as you're aware from the forecast yesterday by Sue Porter, a growth of about 7% in the inmate population in this biennium, and this becomes obviously a significant issue for the operations division. It's broken into actually several areas as well, and it has various units associated with it. The first is the institutions unit, and on page 9 you'll see those listed, and we'll take a minute and just review those. But there's also the health services unit, which I referenced previously. Physical health, mental health, and pharmacy are in the health services unit. A unit which includes the chief of security, which includes our institution audits, the security audits, inmate transfer that handles the management of the inmates' population and where they're at within the system, transport, security threat groups, which is gang management and other security threat group issues, our emergency preparedness structure, and the central inmate mail operations. To give you a sense of the scope of some of these issues, on the health services, for example, I was able to get a little, and part of what I'm trying to do is just set a little bit of a stage. Our biennial budget for health services in the governor's recommended budget is about $88,695,000 for the health services that we provide within the system. I'd give you a sense of the size of the issues that we're talking about when we're talking about health services. And to give you a sense of the issues that we deal with, there are 320,000 on-site medical encounters that occur within the Department of Corrections annually. So I share that with you in part just to give you a sense of the kinds of volume that we're dealing with respect to health-related issues. Similarly, with respect to mail operations, we are literally processing millions of pieces of mail through the department on an annual basis. As you can imagine, not only the mail that comes into the department for staff purposes, but the inmate mail is substantial and requires a fair amount of management. Inmate work programs is another unit in the institutions division. The overall ballot measure 17 compliance, our work crew contracts, our mobile work camps, and our firefighting support that we do with both the Oregon Department of Forestry and the U.S. Forest Service. We have a unit on capacity and resource management. These are the folks that help us manage the population, our special population management. They make decisions about our intensive management unit and protective custody, and also oversee our emergency beds, our rental beds, and our liaison with our youthful offenders in the Oregon Youth Authority. And then finally, on page 9, our operations management unit in the operations division, which has responsibility for the division automation, policy development, and oversight of policy and compliance issues within the operations division. You'll see now on page 9 all of the institutions listed. There are 12 currently operating institutions within the Department of Corrections. The bottom one you'll see listed is the Warner Creek Correctional Facility, which is a 400-bed minimum custody facility being constructed currently in Lakeview. That facility is scheduled to come online in September of 2005. The others you'll see are a mix of medium, minimum, and maximum custody facilities. Our only maximum custody facility is at the penitentiary in Salem. Everything else is medium and minimum custody facilities, and you'll see the expanded capacity number of beds available on the right-hand side of the column. That expanded capacity is a reference to not only the budgeted capacity for the institution, but those temporary and emergency beds which we have added to the institution, not only this last biennium, but in previous biennia when we've been asked to add temporary and emergency beds. As I shared with you before, we expanded our temporary and emergency beds to the fullest extent in August of this of 2004 and began renting jail beds from the counties following that date.
Director Williams, Representative
Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, could you, for my education, for we've had budgeting 101, so I guess this is 201, and, maximum, medium, and minimum. Can you determine that? What determines that? Is it the sentencing?
There are several factors, and I'd be pleased to just touch on them lightly with you. Our maximum custody inmates are primarily made up of two types. They are those who have been sentenced to death, and we have 29 inmates that are currently on death row in Oregon. And the second category are those who have the highest level of misconducts. These are individuals who have had serious assaults on staff, unilateral assaults on other inmates causing injury, anyone who has tried to commit an arson within the facility or who has been apprehended with the possession of some sort of a weapon within the facility. To give you a sense of the number, we have only 3% of our population within the system is currently classed as a maximum custody inmate. The second category, There are some inmates that are referred to as close custody, and they're not shown separately on the sheet because we have close custody facilities that operate in our disciplinary segregation units at several different facilities. But the close custody inmates are inmates who don't qualify based on their conduct for maximum, but they've had six major misconducts within a designated period of time. Those major misconducts are not the highest level, but are misconducts that have disrupted the normal operations of the institution. The closed custody inmates represent about 6% of the total population currently within the department. The medium custody inmates are made up of two types. Those who are serving a sentence of more than 36 months is primarily if you're going to be in. Operating institutions within the Department of Corrections. The bottom one you'll see listed is the Warner Creek Correctional Facility, which is a 400-bed minimum custody facility being constructed currently in Lakeview. That facility is scheduled to come online in September of 2005. The others you'll see are a mix of medium, minimum, and maximum custody facilities. Our only maximum custody facility is at the penitentiary in Salem. Everything else is medium and minimum custody facilities, and you'll see the expanded capacity number of beds available on the right-hand side of the column. That expanded capacity is a reference to not only the budgeted capacity for the institution, but those temporary and emergency beds which we have added to the institution, not only this last biennium, but in previous biennia when we've been asked to add temporary and emergency beds. As I shared with you before, we expanded our temporary and emergency beds to the fullest extent in August of this of 2004 and began renting jail beds from the counties following that date.
Director Williams, Representative Wisnett has
the question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, could you, for my education, for we've had budgeting 101, so I guess this is 201, and maximum, medium, and minimum. Can you determine that? What determines that? Is it the sentencing?
There are several factors, and I'd be pleased to just touch on them lightly with you. Our maximum custody inmates are primarily made up of two types. They are those who have been sentenced to death, and we have 29 inmates that are currently on death row in Oregon. And the second category are those who have the highest level of misconducts. These are individuals who have had serious assaults on staff, unilateral assaults on other inmates causing injury, anyone who has tried to commit an arson within the facility or who has been apprehended with the possession of some sort of a weapon within the facility. To give you a sense of the number, we have only 3% of our population within the system is currently classed as a maximum custody inmate. The second category, there are some inmates that are referred to as close custody, and they're not shown separately on the sheet because we have close custody facilities that operate in our disciplinary segregation units at several different facilities. But the close custody inmates are inmates who don't qualify based on their conduct for maximum, but they have had six major misconducts within a designated period of time. Those major misconducts are not the highest level, but are misconducts that have disrupted the normal operations of the institution. The closed custody inmates represent about 6% of the total population currently within the department. The medium custody inmates are made up of two types. Those who are serving a sentence of more than 36 months is primarily, if you're going to be in for over 36 months to release, you would be considered a medium custody inmate. Also, if you have an escape history or if you have other pending felony charges, in other words, you're not done with the charges that are against you that may be pending in another matter, and that might increase your prison term, you would be considered to be in medium custody. As well as if you are serving less than 12 months, but you've had, or less than 36 months, but you've had two major misconducts, you would be considered a medium custody inmate. So you can get yourself from a minimum to a medium, even if you're close to release, depending on the kind of and level of misconduct. About 51% of our population are medium custody inmates.
What percent?
51%, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnant. The minimum custody inmate are those that have less than 36 months on their release, and they have no more than one misconduct in the last 12 months. So they're within 36 months of release, and they've had about a clean record. They are compliant with their correction plans. They have no pending felony charges and no escape history, and they represent about 38% of our population. There are challenges as you look on the sheet and you see the references to custody level. You'll note that some institutions have a medium as well as a co-located minimum located on the grounds. We have different kinds of minimums as well. We have two minimum facilities, the Forest Camp out on the Tillamook Forest, as well as located in Salem and Mill Creek Correctional Facility, which are unfenced minimums, and we make a distinction internally as to which inmates can actually be in an unfenced minimum and work in that environment. These are typically work camp settings. They work on supervised work crews, but we limit the kind of inmates that we allow in an unfenced minimum because of their access to the community. So sex offenders, for example, are limited to, even if they're a minimum custody inmate, would be limited from being involved in an unfenced minimum outside work crew environment. Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Williams, just so that I know that there's probably everyone here is practically, not everyone, but almost everyone's a Corrections Division employee.
I hope not everyone, Mr. Chairman. They've heard this once already.
Okay. But the public should not confuse these classifications, maximum, medium, minimum, in any way with the potential of a person getting out of the institution through abnormal means, correct? I mean, in the sense of a lot of times, I think, particularly when thinking back in decades prior, when there would be cases of people, you would see cases, particularly in the Statesman Journal, of people escaping from institutions, and to a large extent, what they were largely escaping from is outside work crews, and that actual escapes from maximum or medium facilities or minimum facilities from people actually inside are very rare, although they have occurred.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that would be a very fair assessment. We have had very few escapes from either our from any of our fenced institutions, and to the extent that we have someone who is classified as an escape today, more often than not, it has been someone who has walked off an outside work crew. So they have been a low-risk, minimum custody inmate who has been working on an outside work crew. And when I say low-risk, I don't mean no risk. I mean that given the process that we do risk assessment within the department on who qualifies for outside work crew, they've been identified as being a lower-risk inmate. As I try to remind people, everyone we have in our system has been sentenced to serve more than a year in prison for the conviction of a felony. So there is some risk associated with everybody that we have in the system. But to meet our Measure 17 requirements and to keep people employed and to provide that service back to the community through inmate work, we have to make decisions about who go out on outside work crew. And thankfully, there have been just a handful. And we'll get into walk away from work crew along with other escapes will be an issue that we'll want to cover with you in our performance measures, because we think it's an important issue to for the department to continue to focus on. Are there any questions before I move on with just issues about the institutions themselves? I think you can see, based on the size of the bed capacity, gives you a bit of a sense. Not all institutions are equal. Some, we have some very small institutions. We have some very large institutions. It's important to note that a couple of them we co-manage through through a single superintendent. So the Mill Creek facility and the Sandy Am Correctional Institution, while they're two separate institutions, they're managed by a single superintendent. Likewise, the Columbia River Correctional Institution and South Fork Forest Camp are managed by a single superintendent. So while we have 13 institutions that will be up and running in September, will remain with 11 superintendents within the system.
Director Williams, could you also provide, not today, but it's probably relatively simple to do, a list of the institutions and the date they came online?
Would be pleased to do so, Mr. Chairman. The next page is just sort of a reference for mapping purposes. It'll give you a sense of where our institutions are located, and I won't take the time to go through this except to point out for you that when you look at the boxes, those are the proposed institutions, and the circles are the currently operating institutions. You'll see number 13, which is the facility located in Lakeview, is the next one to come online. We'll be talking to you later in the week about the Madras facility, which will be located in Jefferson County. And then the next two on the long-term construction plan for the department would be Junction City and White City, located in Jackson County. And we can talk about those at a later point if you're interested. The next thing I'd like to chat with you about is the central administration function of the department. The central administration function, which includes the director's office and the deputy director's office, also includes our public affairs unit, our research and evaluation unit, the planning and budget unit, which I've referenced, our project management unit, internal audits, and the inspector general's function. I refer to this, for my purposes, as sort of the toolbox necessary to operate the department. These functions all generally tie to issues involving accountability, efficient and smart management of the affairs of the department, and tie back to ensuring that we continue to run safe, secure, and clean institutions. And I'll take just a minute to talk about each of these units briefly so you have an understanding of what they do. The largest position authority in the central administration unit exists in the Inspector General's office. This office provides inspections, hearings, and investigations of both inmate and employee activity within the department. This is, some people might refer to it as almost an internal affairs function, but they do more than that because they also manage the hearings process for inmate grievances are managed through that department. They also provide the monitoring of our telephone systems. Inmate telephone calls are monitored. A fair amount of involvement with law enforcement and exchange of information and relationships, and all of the internal investigations that occur inside the department are done through the Office of the Inspector General. Those individuals are both centrally located in Salem, as well as investigators that are outstationed at various institutions where it's been more efficient to do that. The internal audit function We have three internal auditors currently, and they provide the internal audit function for the department, and they provide a variety of audits like any internal audit. They report directly to me. As the audits are completed, I receive those and review them, and we develop an agency action plan to respond to any concerns that have been raised by the auditors. The planning and budget function of the department does our budget administration, as well as our long-term planning and construction functions, including construction management, are managed out of the planning and budget office. Our project management office, which is a small function in the director's office, they apply our standardized project management techniques to key agency-wide initiatives. So since I've been at the department, the project management office has led the managing our mental illness and prison task force. They've done our agency-wide web migration project that we were required to do by DAS, as well as several other transition automation projects that have been ongoing in the department, and they provide those skills. Our public affairs office is the public affairs role for the department. Our media communication, our internal communication and messaging to both inmates and staff, legislative constituent support work and response to both family and public questions generally about operations and issues involving the Department of Corrections. And finally, our research and evaluation unit provides the department with accurate and timely research for management decision making. These research projects cover the gambit for us, issues involving high-risk inmate behaviors, whether or not programs that we're currently involved in are demonstrating effectiveness, impact on sentencing law changes, data warehouse management issues to provide us accurate understandings of the demographics of those individuals housed within our institutions. And our research department partners with numerous higher education institutions, both in-state and out-of-state, to better inform the department and the public safety community generally about the issues that they're involved in. Are there any questions before I move on to a discussion about our general services division?
Yes. I guess I would, we could wait till security program, but Director Williams, in security program, you have an institution audit too, right?
Yes.
Compare then or the why you did that and not have them under internal audit, and how many FTEs are we talking about there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnett, I can certainly get someone to help me answer the FTE question. The difference between the audits is the internal audits function in the department that reports directly to me are primarily your traditional internal auditors. The audits that they're performing are whether or not the department is following procedures for its handling of everything from petty cash to how we're counting the right number of widgets in inventory management and the like. The security audits component of the institutions division is auditing security practices within the department. So that unit will go out and visit an agency, and that's managed through our chief of security. They'll go out and visit an institution and conduct a security audit where they'll determine whether or not they're posting the positions appropriately, whether or not somebody is doing the right number of cell searches, whether they're doing pat-down checks at the right spot, whether they're documenting their review of inmate activity in an appropriate way. So one is really focused on the security aspect of how the institution is operated. And our internal audit function doesn't, those folks don't have the security expertise to perform that. They're more a general internal audit unit as opposed to a security audit unit that the operations division runs through their chief of security office. And I'll be happy, I can't probably do it off the top of my head, but I'll be pleased to give you the sense of how we do the FTE. The chief of security usually puts together a comprehensive team. We don't hire typically a separate person to do the security audit. So the assistant superintendent of security at a different institution might be part of an audit team that would go in and audit another institution to assume to determine whether or not they're following appropriate procedures and practices for security purposes. Did I answer your question, Representative?
Fine, thank you, Mr.
Okay, all right. So our next area is the general services portion. And I meant to mention with central administration, I told you that the operations division was 60%. Our central administration function is about 4% of our overall budget. The general services function of the department is also about 4% of our budget. This includes our distribution facilities, fiscal and information services functions within the department. We did try to locate the business functions of the department generally and centrally in this general services division. This is the unit that provides access to information, the procurement of goods and services, timely distribution of those goods throughout the system. Mostly it is centrally located in Salem, but both in the information systems area and in our warehouse areas, we have people who are outstationed where it makes sense for efficiency purposes to have them at the institutional level to provide that level of support. I can briefly mention that it includes our fiscal services support unit, which is our central accounting, our inmate trust fund, our canteen accounting, contract management, procurement, and our state financial reporting and preparation of DOC's portion of the consolidated accounting financial report that the state prepares annually. Our information systems and services unit obviously manages our computer system for almost 5,000 users, our going on 13 prisons, 36 county probation and parole officers, offices, four administrative offices, and numerous business partners, other stakeholders who have access to that information throughout the system, as well as centrally managing our telephone system. The facility services unit centrally administers the department's repair and maintenance programs for our existing 12 institutions, our leased facilities, our wireless communications, our energy conservation programs and sustainability efforts, and our code compliance, and supervises our expansion projects and remodel efforts, and also helps manage our deferred maintenance program. To give you a sense, the department currently has about $46 million in deferred maintenance currently within the system. I think last session we were allocated $2 million to address our $46 million of deferred maintenance. So it takes a fair amount of management and prioritization to determine where you're going to invest that $2 million.
Wouldn't you say, Director Williams, that the reason that that number is actually relatively low given the capital value of all of your facilities and when you compare it to higher education, which I think has about $600 million in deferred maintenance. Most of your facilities are relatively new.
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, the chair would obviously know the higher education deferred maintenance situation better than I do. I would just simply say that when a building falls down in higher ed, it probably creates a different set of panic than than ours.
Well, I will remind the committee that portions of the Oregon State Penitentiary, I think they actually do predate statehood, I think, or maybe by a year or two.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, certainly the dirt that it sits on predates statehood.
Maybe it's not quite that old.
Much has been on that ground built and rebuilt, but they are very aged facilities that takes an incredible amount of effort and experience to keep in operation and state service.
That was the date Representative Hansen gave me. He was one of the first employees there.
Oh, well, then we're set. The last function for the General Services Division is our distribution services component, and this is they provide primarily the logistical support, statewide inventory management through our central distribution center, which is about a 250,000 square foot warehouse located in Salem, statewide food service standards, and the operation of our food cost controls, menu planning, inmate canteen, and then the transportation and delivery of all of that stuff that we purchase throughout the system to the other institutions, and has been over time, and we'll talk about that in the cost savings portion of the discussion, a real savings opportunity for the department. Next, I'll take you to the issue of the Transitional Services Division. The Transitional Services Division has been organized to focus our efforts to reduce the risk of criminal behavior. As I said, it ties directly to the benchmark and the second half of the department's mission. It's broken into several units as well. Community corrections. This includes the transition and release planning, the interstate compact, and the management of the state community corrections offices in Douglas and Linn County, which we inherited after those two counties opted out. There are 30,000 offenders on parole, probation, and post-prison supervision, and the community corrections system has responsibility for overseeing the activities of those individuals. The Department of Corrections administers the grant dollars, so those come to the Department of Corrections through the general fund budget, and then through a formula are distributed out to the individual counties, and that is managed through our Community Corrections Division. I've already spent some time today talking to you about the Offender Information Sentence Computation Unit, which is where we're at today, and the efforts that they make to both control records and do sentence calculation work for the department. We have a workforce development, our programs portion of the department in workforce development, alcohol and drug treatment, education, work-based education, functional literacy, our cognitive and behavioral programs. All of this is done through the Transitional Services Division. And then religious services, which are our system-wide chaplains who coordinate religious opportunities and volunteer coordination for our individual institutions throughout the system. You might be interested to know that 52% of inmates participate in religious activities within the institution, and we have initiated a Going Home for Good faith-based transition effort with community chaplains who are volunteers, who work with our coordinator to try to develop for those individuals within the system who have established a relationship with the religious community to transition those people into receiving religious communities out in the field when they are transitioning out of the system to try to better create that community support network for those individuals as they are returning. To give you a sense of the Transitional Services Division size, as I've been commenting on this, the total percentage is about 20% of our overall budget of the department is tied up in the Transitional Services Division. But 16.2% of that is the Community Corrections grant money. So almost all of the money that comes into Transitional Services is pass-through money that goes back out to the counties for community corrections. We have about, well, less than 4% that remains in the department for the administration of religious services, workforce development, alcohol and drug treatment, transition and release, the operations of this office, the OISC office, interstate compact, and the like. To give you a sense on the program breakdown, just those programs that are alcohol and drug, cognitive work, workforce development, and religious services make up less than 2.2% of the entire budget of the Department of Corrections. So the effort that we make internally to try to target people to resources and programs within the institutions to make a difference in their transition and effectiveness upon release amounts to 2.18% of the entire department's budget. And I want to share that with you just to have you keep that in perspective when we get into the more detailed discussion in phase two about the various programs, because we'll always and have consistently spent a fair amount of time in that discussion with the committee to just have you recollect that we're really talking about 2.2% of the entire department's budget when we're in the midst of those conversations. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Williams, one of the things perhaps to comment on here is that your staff would be available, you would be available on the community corrections issues to answer questions, because inevitably every member, I know that Representative Hansen will be well aware of this, every member will either be approached by counties in terms of differences of opinion that they may have on community corrections issues, levels of funding, et cetera, and what's appropriate or not. I have a kind of sensitive question to ask you, and I'm not actually advocating any change. But being the corrections director, and you being somewhat similar in a sense to many state agencies, where you're passing money out to a division in terms of community corrections, how much control are you able to exercise over the practices within community corrections, given that they are basically just pass-through funds to county community corrections programs?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the way community corrections was originally structured under Senate Bill 1145, it was intentionally done so to really not put restrictions on the county's use of those resources for community corrections purposes once they were received by the county. I believe that the theory at the time was that
local law enforcement and the local public safety coordinating councils working in cooperation with the county commissions in those counties where the county commission controls community corrections, and with the sheriff in those counties where the sheriff controls community corrections, that collectively that they would be better informed about how to target those resources in their local community. That continues to be the way that that process works. The effort that our community corrections office has made over the years since that time has been to work cooperatively with our county stakeholders to develop collectively approaches with respect to appropriate risk-based management of offenders, evidence-based practices and programs that are available within the system, and to collect data on various issues to report back to the legislature on effectiveness, which was the subject of one of our budget notes from the last legislative session. I would tell you that it's my opinion, and I believe the opinion of the governor, that there is great value in the community corrections model, in part because it does allow those local communities to prioritize for themselves issues of key importance, relying on the resource of the local public safety coordinating council to give input into what the current issue of the day is in that community that they need to respond to. And I would tell you from my own personal perspective, I still believe that it's an effective and functioning model. Different counties will approach things differently with those resources, but public safety is oftentimes a very local issue for a community, and the issue that may be affecting one community, even though similar, may take a different kind of a response, or they may wish to target a different way of approaching it, and I think that flexibility has been provided to them currently. I think it'll be up to the legislature as a policy decision at some point to determine whether or not they're still comfortable with that flexibility.
As a way of a follow-up, 1145, I believe, predates all of us, actually, here. It's either 95 or... 95. It predates everyone here. It doesn't predate you in other ways, I know.
Well, I was working on...
You were on the county side, as I recall, Representative Hansen.
Yes.
He was reminding me of that yesterday.
Right after the facility opened.
But in terms of... I just wanted to put it on the record, not so much because there's a problem, but because this is, again, another one of those areas where we pass out dollars but don't literally have the same kind of controls that sometimes people would expect we have controls in terms of how the expenditures are, and also to ask you and for members here and other members of the committee that are not present, that often you will be approached from counties on the formula, on how much they're receiving, and to probably try to get both sides of that story. So.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Director Williams, as you talk about the community corrections portion, and because Douglas County is one of the two counties that I represent, do you have data yet, given it's been a fairly short timeline, that would suggest one model or the other is measurably better in terms of cost to handle this, cost to the system? I mean, is there a way to compare it very well at this point?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I don't really think that there probably is good data right now to compare from a cost standpoint, which is a more effective model. I would tell you that I think that it's my opinion that bringing community corrections offices back into state service in the long run will be more expensive for the state. And I say that, and you know, Mr. Wilson, your LFO staff, may react to the rudimentary sort of thought process I go through in the management of these numbers, but I think if you bring... you recognize that there is a certain amount of overhead expense that most counties typically are absorbing in the employment of these individuals, in the staff they have for personnel costs, the work that has to be done with respect to accounting and payroll, and some of those overhead administrative expenses. And even those counties which were assessing a certain amount from their county community corrections offices to help pay for that overhead, I think by and large there was some investment by the individual counties in assuming or absorbing a certain amount of those administrative resources in managing their local community corrections offices. We've attempted to absorb most of that as well, although we were given some assistance by the E-Board to help address some of that overhead as Douglas and Linn County came back into our system. As larger counties would potentially come back into the system, Douglas and Linn County together included about 48 positions. So we had about 48 new people who became state employees.
As you talk about the community corrections portion, and because Douglas County is one of the two counties that I represent, do you have data yet, given it's been a fairly short timeline, that would suggest one model or the other is measurably better in terms of cost to handle this, cost to the system? And is there a way to compare it very well at this point?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I don't really think that there probably is good data right now to compare from a cost standpoint, which is a more effective model. I would tell you that I think that it's my opinion that bringing community corrections offices back into state service in the long run will be more expensive for the state. And I say that, and you know, Mr. Wilson, your LFO staff may react to the rudimentary sort of thought process I go through in the management of these numbers. But I think if you bring, you recognize that there is a certain amount of overhead expense that most counties typically are absorbing in the employment of these individuals and in the staff they have for personnel costs. The work that has to be done with respect to accounting and payroll and some of those overhead administrative expenses. And even those counties which were assessing a certain amount from their county community corrections offices to help pay for that overhead, I think by and large there was some investment by the individual counties in assuming or absorbing a certain amount of those administrative resources in managing their local community corrections offices. We've attempted to absorb most of that as well, although we were given some assistance by the E-Board to help address some of that overhead as Douglas and Linn County came back into our system. As larger counties would potentially come back into the system, Douglas and Linn County together included about 48 positions. So we had about 48 new people who became state employees and employees of the Department of Corrections as a result of those opt-outs. Those are mid-sized county offices. There are some that have fewer. There are a number that have much larger employee bases. And as larger groups of employees would come in, the requirement to have, you know, the appropriate management level positions overseeing those offices as they would grow, as well as the administrative infrastructure that would have to be built to manage those resources, I think would ultimately have a cost on the state if you wanted to maintain the same level of community supervision. And I think that's the point. If you want to shave down the amount of money that is actually buying the community corrections resource in the county to pay for that administration that we would have to build in at the state level, you can do it without having it cost you any money. But the trade-off is what you're losing then is you're losing a certain amount of people who are being overseen by parole and probation officers. You're losing, you may be case-baking more inmates. Access to programs like drug and alcohol treatment, sex offender treatment, and others may be less available because you've had to pay for some of that administrative oversight management component. And so there's your trade-off. So I haven't seen the numbers, but as I think through the issue myself personally, I don't know that you could do it cheaper if you brought it back into the state system from a management standpoint. Now, there may be a disagreement as to some counties, because they have their free choice, may not be utilizing their resources in the most effective manner because they've decided, for example, to put more people in jail beds than to use other alternative, less expensive sanctions. So depending on a county-by-county basis, you might get a win in one and might get a lose in the other. And I think those are the kind of policy issues that this committee and the policy committees of the legislature may have to struggle with.
OK. Can I follow up,
yes,
please? Given that, and I appreciate that, you know, we're taking a kind of a look at things because it's a short term. Is the opt out, is the fact that those two counties opted out never back up? I mean, could they ever go back? I mean, how many times could they opt in, opt out? You know, I mean.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanna, you have identified one of my worst nightmares. Because legally, a county can opt in and opt out at its will. In other words, once they've opted out, they can choose to opt back in if they so desire. They can then they're stuck in again unless the funding levels fall below the designated amount for the formula, at which point they can choose to opt back out. So they do have some flexibility about coming in and coming out. If we get in a situation where we're sort of having counties jump in and out a lot, I can tell you that then for sure that's the worst of all possible worlds, because the administrative impact on trying to bring these people back, even in these two small offices, hi, Senator, it just creates a huge amount of effort on our staff's part to try to manage through this process, along with the collective bargaining arrangements and everything else that had to be worked out each time they change, whether they're going to be in county or state service. That would be a bad deal for everybody.
I thought I understood that, and I'm thinking, you know, at some point you'd have to have a rule that says, okay, you're either in or out. And
Representative Hanson, have a question.
Well, yeah, just following up on that question, I don't think that's a decision any county would take very lightly. I mean, it would be probably once in a decade type decision that they make that is incredibly complicated from both sides of the equation.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, I couldn't agree with you more. And I would tell you that the two counties who did make the decision to opt out, I think did so after a lot of deliberative discussion internally. And I certainly respect the choices that they made as individual elected policymakers. They had to evaluate this and come to what they thought was the best determination for their county. And our commitment was all the way along, it wasn't up for us to decide whether it was a good or a bad decision, but once the decision was made, to continue to work with those counties as full partners in trying to provide public safety services to those communities. And that's the commitment that I continue to make to every one of our county partners. You get to decide whether you opt in or out. That's not my choice. I have my preference, obviously, but that's not my choice. And our commitment will be that we will continue to be partners at the table, whether or not we're providing services as a state agency in your community, providing that parole and probation responsibility, or whether we're doing it more from an administrative standpoint and administering the grant and trying to direct you to the best practices to make your offices more effective. I should also point out, for those of us who didn't have the old prior history from a legislative experience, that it used to be that there were a mix of both state and county offices. So this mixed involvement that we are in now, where some are state offices and some are county-controlled offices, is not new ground that has never been plowed before. That was how the situation existed prior to Senate Bill 1145, and it worked as well. You know, different people have different opinions about whether it was more or less effective. So it's not a place that the department hasn't been before. And some of the people that we are bringing back into state service now were in state service with the department prior to 1145. So they've been in state service, went to the counties, and are now back in state service.
One clarification: it's not as bad as an acronym, but just a brief explanation for the committee of what you mean by case banking so people understand.
I appreciate the direction, Mr. Chairman. Case banking is just a term that's used typically when you are at a point where you cannot provide the direct level of supervision at the level that you might want, or maybe even that the case might need. The individual is stuck on a case bank, which means they have a very limited contact with someone who is providing oversight. And in some cases, the understanding is that they have virtually no contact. So you're taking someone and putting them on the stack, and it's usually done based on risk. So you try to have a lot of supervision of your people who you think have the highest likelihood of reoffending. a little less supervision because of your budget management issues for those who you think have a higher risk, but they're not as high as the high highs. And then you get down to the end where you probably can't afford to provide the level of supervision that you might want to afford or provide, but you put them on a case bank and they have limited contact or limited supervision. And people typically move sometimes down that path. They don't just appear one way or the other, but they may have been high at some point and over time move to a low-risk category.
Just to make sure the committee understands a couple issues. When a county makes a determination to opt out, they have to give 180-day, at least 180-day notice to the state. So it's not real quick, but 180 days goes real quick in terms of working out the arrangements with the counties. The other thing is, in the governor's budget does cut community corrections to the point where counties will have the option to opt out, given the governor's budget, and it'll either cost $9 million to close that gap or $18 million, depending on who you talk to. If you talk to LFO, we'll say it's roughly $9 million.
The last division that I wanted to mention was our human resources division. And the Human Resources Division of the department is responsible for all aspects of our employee services, including employee-labor relations, our recruitment function, our payroll and personnel records function, human resources services, safety and risk management, training, classification, compensation, and affirmative action are all contained in our Human Resources Division. Human Resources accounts for only 1% of the department's overall budget, but it is a critical and strategic part of our operation. As you obviously understand, the Department of Corrections is truly a people business. What we do is manage those offenders that are under our supervision in numerous ways, and that requires people to do that job. Who those people are, how they're recruited, how they're trained, the relationships we have with them through our labor organizations are all very critical to the department successfully achieving its mission. So we take the function very, very seriously, and it's an important part of what the department does. I don't need to probably spend a lot of time talking to you about the individual units in human resources because I know you're all familiar with what a payroll and personnel records unit does. But this is also from our safety and risk management standpoint that manages workplace safety, our practices, our reporting on our workers' compensation issues, and our efforts to keep our workers' compensation numbers as low as possible for workplace injuries and the like. The other point I would make is that the staff training and employee development is a critical function that this unit plays. The corrections environment is a changing and complicated environment with respect to dealing with inmates with serious mental illness issues. The very nature of the kinds of inmates that come in today and the changing expectations that the department has with respect to how we provide these services. And a staff training and employee development plays a key role in trying to keep us where we need to be professionally as corrections professionals within the system. So that concludes my initial overview of the four divisions.
Quick question on training. When the new police training facility opens, will that increase your training costs? Will the duration of training increase?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I do not believe that there is any expectation at this point that our duration of training will increase. We will train at the new facility, which is actually located on Department of Corrections property. We made DPSST a really good deal, and they leased that property for us for $1 a year. I'm trying to figure out how to get former Senator Minnis to trade us something in return for that, but it's a good deal for them, and it's a good deal for us because it's close to our central base of operations between several of our facilities in Salem, and we look forward to being able to train in that new environment. But our duration of training will not change, and that's not anticipated in the budget. Along with that DPSST training, which is required for our security folks, We also have a new employee orientation training that we perform at the department for every new employee, whether or not you're a security staff or whether you're coming in as, you know, working in the kitchen as a food service coordinator or some other role. And then we provide annual in-service training as well to our employees, a week's worth of annual in-service training, which I can tell you is woefully inadequate to cover the various issues, both everything from, you know, CPR training to the, you know, to armed post training to, you know, dealing with issues. Again, we're focusing this year on mental health and staff inmate interactions and the like, but there's always more information that we ought to be training on and not enough time or resources, frankly, to provide it. But it is critical to the long-term operations of the department.
Mr. Williams, one thing on the human resources, just to give the committee some idea. In your operations division, you have approximately 4,000 positions in the governor's budget and about 3,800 FTE. Most of those, not all of them by any means, but probably I would guess three-quarters of those are probably custody staff. How many new hires do you have to get basically each month to basically keep your positions? I know you don't have your positions full, also. But literally, how many people do you need to bring through the system to fill your slots each month?
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm not sure. I know that our HR director could give me the answer to that question, but I would tell you that I think we struggle consistently on recruitment within the system for a variety of reasons. One, it's a job that a lot of people, frankly, aren't interested in, and so we're having to find the right people, and we use a lot of different methodologies to try to recruit appropriately. To enhance that challenge, I think, is that we have had a number of vacancies driven both by our need to meet the legislative requirement of the vacancies we were told to hold vacant to meet budget expectation, combined with issues, for example, on the east side, particularly where we've had a large number of our staff who have been involved in military call-ups with respect to both Afghanistan and Iraq. Coupled with a lot of facilities located in remote parts of the state where the population base is difficult to fulfill the need that we have to operate those facilities. So I can't give you an exact number. I can tell you that certainly included in the position authority with respect to Madras and the Coffee Creek or the Coffee Creek expansion, as well as our opening of Warner Creek, are some positions tied to the HR function for everything from recruitment to generally, once you've hired those employees, providing the standard human resources services necessary to have the right number of HR consultants who are working with, you know, staff in the institution and management in the institution to deal with, you know, the traditional HR issues that we have to deal with in a department of this size. And we can show you in the further portion of the presentation as we get into most of the divisional detail, if you'd like to do that, where those positions are and how they move into the various pieces as a result of that expansion. And I've got some information I can walk through now if the committee wants to go there now, or if you want to wait and do that in a more detailed way down the road, we can do that then as well.
We may do it in more detail. Our basic plan right now is to basically do whatever we can here by about 2:40 and then get people over for the tours of the facilities. And I know that there are some members that need to get back to some area for a dinner.
What he means is that some of us have to have a distance to travel, or some of us are close at hand at home by the facility. And
yeah.
So, like the good senator here.
And Mr. Chair, we'd be pleased to accommodate the committee's schedule. My understanding was that you did want to finish at about 20 till 3. We'd use a little bit of time then transition the members into the tour of the institutions. Several of you will go into the minimum, and several of you will go into the medium, and then we'll switch at some point. And I was told that you wanted to be out of the heading to your cars at about 4:45. Will that sufficiently accommodate the members' schedules?
Will that work for everyone?
Yeah, okay. All right.
Good. Please proceed to whatever you think.
I'll go as far as I can go in the time that I've been allotted, and then we'll move forward.
And you don't have to give it to me now, but it would be helpful when you start giving the detail is to give us what your workers' comp trends have been over time and per facility.
We'd be pleased to do that. Yeah, happy to do that. The next area in the presentation that I'd like to chat with you about is the budget drivers and the various environmental factors affecting the agency. Obviously, our biggest budget driver is focused on the population forecast, and you heard Ms. Porter review those numbers with you yesterday from the Office of Economic Analysis. During this biennium, we're projected to increase the number of inmates in the system by about 962 inmates, so almost 1,000 inmates over the next 2 years from July 05 forward. And the plan to accommodate this increase is several fold. It includes the use of continued temporary and emergency beds within the existing institutions. We added 441 of those beds in this last biennium to deal with that. The 400 beds that would become available at the Warner Creek facility in September in Lakeview. The 100-bed expansion at the Shutter Creek facility in North Bend, which was approved by the E-Board, which would become available in December of 2005. The use of available local jail bed rentals, which we have currently in process, where we have rented from, I think we have contracts now with three counties, and those are increasing. And then to do the expansion of both the Madras facility and the women's facility to deal with the substantial spike in the female population that was reflected in the presentation by Ms. Porter yesterday. We will request that the committee move forward with the authorization of the Madras men's facility and the expansion of the women's facility here in Wilsonville. During February of 2005, we know that's a short time frame, but it's driven primarily by our ability to get in front of the construction cycle and the necessary sale of the COPs to allow that to happen. And this will be the focus of sort of the last day and a half conversation as we walk the committee both through the specifics of these plans and the alternatives that we would present to the committee as things the department reviewed before moving forward with the determination. On page 14, you'll see the chart that was, again, shown to you yesterday. This comes from Ms. Porter's population forecast and is simply just a visual reminder of the challenges that the department faces with respect to population management in the short term. Other challenges that we have reflected on page 15 of our presentation. Obviously, as you add additional bodies, even in temporary emergency beds, into the institutions, it becomes an increasingly difficult challenge when you've exceeded planned capacity to maintain safe operations within the system. Simply more people in a confined space creates possibilities for additional conflict and challenges. We also struggle to deliver the kind of program that we would like to deliver while these individuals are incarcerated for two reasons. One, the resources, frankly, aren't sufficient to provide the level of program to those who have the need, combined with when you have to shift resources to deal with a crowded population environment, it creates bigger challenges. Along with that, as those skills are designed to help people reenter the community, we face challenges on the outside as well as these people move from our facilities back into the community with respect to having access to the appropriate education, housing, employment, and treatment opportunities to have whatever we have been able to provide them within the inside make a lasting impact as they transition back out. You've heard a lot, and I don't want to beat the dead horse with you about our mental health population. I know this is coming at you from several different ways as you're discussing mental health needs of the state generally, but we have almost 23% of our population has a diagnosable mental health issue that's considered to be more than just a behavioral issue. 14% of our population have severe persistent mental health needs. We have ongoing physical health issues, as I reflected to you in my just giving you a contextual reference of the size of our budget with just respect to the issues of medical is substantial. This is a population that by their very nature a worse physical health than their chronological age might indicate and creates ongoing problems for the department. Our ability to provide the appropriate level of addiction treatment resources is as well. I think I've shared with you before that 70% of our population approximately has an addiction, drug and alcohol related need, and we have currently operating, and these wouldn't be currently operating under the governor's recommended budget because we lose about $2.2 million in drug and alcohol treatment. But currently we have about 508 treatment beds for drug and alcohol addiction within a system when we have, you know, easily between 6,000 to 9,000 individuals within the system who have a substantial need. Our continued compliance with ballot measure 17 remains an issue. We're required to employ all inmates in some amount of reasonable work for 40 hours a week. That doesn't come without a cost, and it doesn't come without an impact on how we have to manage within the system, both from moving as many inmates into meaningful outside work that can offset cost to taxpayers, as well as within the institution and the management of the facility. It is simply not as easy as saying if you need 30 inmates currently to run a kitchen and you got 30 people idle, you just put 30 more inmates in the kitchen, so now you have 60 inmates in a kitchen. At some point, those issues become a real challenge for security practices within the organization, so we have to balance our duty and obligation to employ these inmates in meaningful work against the potential risks it creates for security and operations of the institution. And we try very hard to achieve compliance with Measure 17, but we've never been at 100% compliance, and I would suggest to you that as we continue to crowd the institutions, our compliance rates will likely continue to fall.
Senator Winters, yes.
Mr. Williams, I wanted to say representative.
You can call me whatever you want, Senator.
When you take away the medical, those that are medically infirm, so that they're not a part of the measure 17 pool, what is that number then that you're actually looking at trying to get to? 100%, and I realize the difficulty. What percentage are you attaining?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, we are below 80% right now on our Measure 17 reported compliance. We do under the Constitution and the rule that we have in the department exclude certain people who are unable to work because of their infirmity. And I can't tell you the number, but we will get the answer to that question for you and tell you from the overall population base of about 12,700, how many are deemed work ready for Measure 17 purposes. I will also tell you that we exclude the individuals who are spending their time, their first 22 days in the intake process while we're going through assessment until we've moved them through the assessment process, developed their correction plan, and sent them out to the institution. It's not effective in part because we also don't have a good understanding of where we're going to classify that inmate from the kind of facility that they're going to be in to have them engaged in outside work. And even internally, we aren't sure, quite frankly, at that point where to put them, and they're engaged in that assessment process. So there are several other categories of inmates who are not Measure 17 compliant but because of the kind of issues that they have. But it is a challenge and becomes more so as we continue to get more inmates and try to find meaningful, and the key is meaningful things for them to be engaged in. It's somewhat self-defeating from the pro-social standpoint of what we're trying to achieve under the Oregon accountability model to have somebody mopping the same square over and over again when it's not actually producing any kind of meaningful result. And so we try to be honest about what kind of work we're providing to inmates because we don't think it does them any good to have them doing something that isn't meaningful.
Can you give some examples of the kinds of security issues that this might present in terms of, just so the committee has an understanding? I know you have this requirement and you're trying to comply with the requirement. But what I used to hear probably when I first came into the
well, I shouldn't say into the institution, into the legislature. It is, in a sense.
Yes, it is. Mr. Chairman.
What I would hear, Mr. Williams, is things like, well, I don't know what the current practice is, but back then, which was in 97, 98, sort of the things about, you know, that you might have a couple of orderlies normally in a unit before, people that would assist the correctional officer on duty, but now you'd be required to have five or six. So you and orderlies do two things. One, they assist you, and the other thing is they run things between cells, and they do all kinds of things if you don't watch them. And now you have to watch five or six of them. And
right. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a classic example. The other one that I'm probably most familiar with was conversations that I've had about impacts of Measure 17. Initially, it was things like doubling the number of people you have working in the kitchen, to the point that it was people were incapable to be supervising effectively, given both the size of the area that you had this many people working in, as to what was going on in that environment with respect to everything from, you know, tool control to, you know, whether or not you could keep your eye on people for, you know, various other kinds of activities that might be going on that process. So we have tried to find, I think, within the department an appropriate balance while recognizing our constitutional obligation under Measure 17 to also focus on our constitutional obligation to run safe and secure institutions. And I think that's one of the challenges that we're constantly involved in. Third to that, I think, that you have to consider as well is that as we attempt to expand the kinds of things that inmates do, whether it's work through Oregon Correctional Enterprises or even our outside work crews who might be providing the Parks Department with trail development services or the like, if we get very effective at using inmates for almost any purpose, we end up causing some group or organization a certain amount of discomfort, and they like to come and tell me about it. So if it's the possibility that inmates are displacing public employees, I obviously hear about that from the public employees' representatives who are concerned about the use of inmate labor for those purposes. If we're too good at doing something that now looks like we're competing with private business that may be displacing private workers, I hear from the private side who wants to come and tell me that we're potentially impacting their population base as well. So the department has been given a very, very big challenge, I think, to try to accomplish the issue of putting every inmate to work in a meaningful way while reducing the overall cost to taxpayers without, of course, offending groups on either side of that spectrum if we do it very well. It's a serious challenge. One of the
just so the committee has an understanding. I know you have this requirement, and you're trying to comply with the requirement, but what I used to hear probably when I first came into the, well, I shouldn't say into the institution, into the legislature. It is, in a sense.
Yes, it is. Mr. Chairman.
What I would hear, Mr. Williams, is things like, well, I don't know what the current practice is, but back then, which was in 97, 98, sort of the things about, you know, that you might have a couple of orderlies normally in a unit before, people that would assist the correctional officer on duty, but now you'd be required to have five or six. So you could,
an orderlies do two things. One, they assist you, and the other thing is they run things between cells, and they do all kinds of things if you don't watch them. And now you have to watch five or six of them.
Right. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a classic example. The other one that I'm probably most familiar with was conversations that I've had about impacts of Measure 17. Initially, it was things like doubling the number of people you have working in the kitchen, to the point that it was people were incapable to be supervising effectively, given both the size of the area that you had this many people working in, as to what was going on in that environment with respect to everything from tool control to whether or not you could keep your eye on people for various other kinds of activities that might be going on in that process. So we have tried to find, I think, within the department an appropriate balance while recognizing our constitutional obligation under Measure 17 to also focus on our constitutional obligation to run safe and secure institutions. And I think that's one of the challenges that we're constantly involved in. Third to that, I think, that you have to consider as well is that as we attempt to expand the kinds of things that inmates do, whether it's work through Oregon Correctional Enterprises or even our outside work crews who might be providing the Parks Department with trail development services or the like, if we get very effective at using inmates for almost any purpose, we end up causing some group or organization a certain amount of discomfort, and they like to come and tell me about it. So if it's the possibility that inmates are displacing public employees, I obviously hear about that from the public employees' representatives, who are concerned about the use of inmate labor for those purposes. If we're too good at doing something that now looks like we're competing with private business that may be displacing private workers, I hear from the private side who wants to come and tell me that we're potentially impacting their population base as well. So the department has been given a very, very big challenge, I think, to try to accomplish the issue of putting every inmate to work in a meaningful way while reducing the overall cost to taxpayers without, of course, offending groups on either side of that spectrum if we do it very well. It's a serious challenge, and one of the reasons I think that the department continues to struggle to achieve the level. I will tell you, inside of our department, we use inmate resources to offset the costs of government substantially, from everything from yard work, as I mentioned, kitchen crew, to various other kinds of janitorial function and the like. And it's a very effective means of the department employing those people in meaningful work and as part of their contributing to the cost of their care through that. So we certainly would not want to move back away from a Measure 17 approach because we think it's been a healthy thing for the department and a healthy thing for the inmates. But I think it's something that the committee has to understand the challenges that it presents, particularly in a growing environment.
Representative. And then has any of your policy people given thought or discussion to dedicating one of the facilities to inmates with mental health problems?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, we are in the process right now of working through a series of changes that we think will make us more effective at assessing and dealing with the mental health issue. In spring of last year, I commissioned an internal review called our Managing Mental Illness in Prison Task Force, which not only included DOC staff, but folks from DHS and the Oregon State Hospital. It included a representative from NAMI, the Oregon OAC, Bob Jundiff's group, to participate on that as we reviewed the way we were managing mental health issues within the system. And out of that came a report with some substantial recommendations, which is moving us more towards the model that you've described. It's a complicated process when you're talking about massive inmate movement. The noted challenge that we had was the need for a place between general population and our special management unit where we have our most severe and persistent currently mentally ill active people
We have very few of those SMU beds within the system, some at the penitentiary and some at Coffee Creek. Very limited opportunities for sort of the step-down bed where someone would go to still a supportive community that was less than or more supportive than just dropping this individual back into the general population. So we are moving that direction. Obviously, we're in conversation with a lot of people within the department about how to effectively make that transition over time. Down the road, I think it's going to be necessary for the department to consider not only the size of our mental health population, but our aging population from a geriatric standpoint and our persistent and chronic disease population. And those conversations we are having with respect to the possibility of when we move to the point in the forecast where we would have to be talking to the legislature about the construction of the Junction City facility, which would not be in this biennium, but theoretically in the next biennium, we would be talking about probably some structural design functions of that facility to address our most chronic health, mental health, and geriatric population in that conversation. And those conversations are very preliminary right now, but if you look at the jump just in the aging population that we've had and the impact of the lengthened sentences with respect to some of that population, we're seeing substantial increases in the number of inmates that we have that are over the age of 60, and we'll continue to see that in the foreseeable future.
Thank you. This is an area that I've had some serious concern. I've had some conversation with Ms. Green, both in terms of the mental health population as well as the growing, aging, and population that is chronically ill. Combine that with a major cost driver in this budget is the medical piece that's inside of this budget. And we have to look at some solutions long term. That population is growing, and currently we receive, it's all general funded. We do not receive any federal match for medical costs.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I shared with the committee before you arrived just as a context piece that our total biennial budget for health services, which includes medical, mental health, and pharmacy in this biennium, is $88 million. Medical services is about $56 million of that. Our mental health is about $15 million, a little more than that. Our pharmacy operations is about $17 million, of which for the biennium, about $12 million of that is the actual drug costs associated. And we're part of a statewide multi-state consortium on drug purchases that actually, I think, makes us a fairly effective purchaser of drugs at a substantial savings, and it's still $12 million in a biennium is a substantial amount of money, obviously. And I would tell you that I think the mental health drugs are probably the key drivers of much of that cost. The last, oh, I'm sorry.
Williams, actually, I'm just trying to make sure the committee understands some of these issues. Can you just give a brief explanation in terms of just so people understand that although you make these decisions anyway, probably, but much of what you have to do in the institution here is based on constitutional requirements and court cases and...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the chair is correct. We make an effort to be very cautious in how we manage the state's resources with respect to the delivery of service. But we do have obligations, both constitutional and statutory, about the kinds of services that we are required to provide, along with, obviously, moral obligations to treat these individuals in a very humane and fair manner. The constitutional obligation was determined by the United States Supreme Court with respect to the delivery of medical services that requires that we not be deliberately indifferent to an inmate's pain. So I have had several people ask me the question, for example, as I have talked briefly about the dental woes, which we haven't covered today, and I'll save for another conversation with you. that we have with respect to the providing of dental services within the system. And I've had several people say, well, if we're eliminating dental off of the Oregon Health Plan, why should we not eliminate dental out of the Department of Corrections? And I reminded them that once the state, for whatever reason, has made the decision to take away the individual's liberty interest, our constitutional obligation to not be deliberately indifferent to their pain, including dental abscess, toothache, and the like, requires us to provide that level of service. If they're not within our custody, then obviously the state has a different relationship to them. But to the extent that we stand in that custodial role, then we are obligated under the Constitution to provide that level of service. I want you to understand that the level of service that we provide is not a carte blanche level of service. Particularly with respect to dental care, it is primarily episodic. It is not even a managed health care approach to dental care. It is a treat the emergency approach, and even then we struggle to meet a level that we're comfortable with. On the medical front, we attempt to run a more managed health care approach and not episodic because of the cost involved with simply treating people in an episodic fashion. And I think we've been fairly successful at demonstrating a savings over the way that we have managed our health care system within the department. The last point on the challenges that I'd make, Representative Wisden had a question, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real fast, Director Williams, could you put me in touch with whoever handles your ballot measure 17? Is that the workforce development? I have constituents that are concerned about losing their jobs for this, and see if we can talk about how we can work together. I have constituents that have firefighting crews in Central Oregon.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, you're probably aware that I met with them. I don't know, maybe you didn't know that. I met with them over the summer. We've had some fairly lengthy conversations with them and the Forest Service, and the last report I got is that things were progressing actually rather well. And we're looking for every opportunity we can to find somebody to partner with, frankly, within the system in both private and public enterprise to make this work successfully. But I will have someone contact you directly, share with you what we've done so far with respect to their specific concerns.
Thank you.
Can you close in about 30 seconds?
I can close by pointing you on page...
I just have a comment. I wasn't aware that there was a problem in your area with inmates and firefighting. That's well to know because I got involved in the B&B. And I have to tell you that in protecting... I'll pay.
You can have one of my dollars.
But in getting involved in helping to contain, particularly when the fire was leaping over and going into Marion Forks, and getting into the private forest, I have to tell you, I was very thankful to have all of the firefighters and to have corrections, and I was up there watching and observing. And my hat went off to everybody that was involved, and I think when we have a major catastrophe like that, I don't know, there were so many bodies, both private and public, that I think we could have had even more to help. But I wanted to say a thank you to your department. Your people handled themselves very well. If they had not been there, we would not have been able to contain that fire in coming over and then into up towards the valley. So,
and I,
good and
Senator,
bad, there's a balance in all
sure.
of this.
And I appreciate that, and thank you very much. We're very proud, actually, of our relationship with both the Forest Service and the State Department of Forestry with respect to the training. We don't intend to be the first line of defense, but we are the backup crews when a number of crews have been called out to other places and even out of state, and they've served very well and faithfully. A somewhat different issue with respect to the crews that are working over on the Deschutes, because they're primarily doing fuels reduction work out in the forest. And those are issues that would be pleased, and again, have been pleased to sit down and talk to them about, and we'll be happy to provide that information. I won't take any more time on the major changes in the past 10 years, because in the course of our conversation, I really believe that we've covered most of them. They really have been primarily driven by issues involving major legislative change, either driven by the legislature or driven by the people through the use of the initiative or referendum. Measure 11, Measure 17, 1145 have been primary drivers within the department, and we touched briefly on both our constitutional and statutory obligations. So what I'd like to do is hold us at this point for tomorrow to begin the conversation in our presentation under the heading of cost control activities. I think we can move fairly quickly through the remainder of the presentation, talk to you briefly about our performance measures, overview with you our priority list, and also talk to you about our affirmative action report, and still have some time left over to introduce the conversation tomorrow in the Capitol about our population management plan and the issues related to construction. So I would hope that that would meet with the chair's approval.
Thank you, Mr. Williams, and hopefully Senator Gordley will be back here in the coming days. I'll adjourn the committee at this point, and I think we can actually make the arrangements for the tours rather informally. I would remind members of the committee, staff that are accompanying people on the tours, that it might be easier to use the facilities here than at any of the places that we are going. So if anyone needs the facilities, they should be using them now.
Very good.
We will adjourn.